You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Hammond, historian curator here at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. Spycast's sole purpose is to educate our listeners about the past, present, and future of intelligence and espionage. Every week, through engaging conversations, we explore some aspect of a vast ecosystem that looms beneath the surface of everyday life. We talk to spies, operators, mole hunters, defectors, analysts and authors to explore the stories and secrets, tradecraft and technology of the secret world. We are Spycast. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Welcome to this week's episode of Spycast. Have you ever wondered how a Russian intelligence officer is trained? Ever wondered what it would be like to be a defector? Ever wondered what it would be like to be given three choices: shoot yourself, get shot, or go on the run? If so, you'll appreciate this week's episode with Jan Neumann, who was born Alexei Yurevich Artamonov in the former Soviet Union. Jan's father was a KGB internal affairs officer, and he would go on to join one of his successors, the FSB, or Federal Security Service, in which his wife also served. He's involved in a number of projects here in the States where he now lives, which we discuss in the episode. In this episode, we discuss how one gets recruited into Russian intelligence, what the training is like for its officers, what it's like to run counterintelligence on the streets of Moscow, and spotting, assessing, and recruiting agents from Jan's point of view. If you appreciate Spycast and the hard work we do bringing it to you every week, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. It will mean a lot to us, even if you write a single sentence. I'm so glad that we finally got around to doing this, because we met way back when, a couple of years ago, for a program, a public program at the Spy Museum, and we've been trying to arrange this for between the intervening period, and so much has happened. So I'm really glad that now we're finally doing it.
Yeah, Andrew, thank you for having me here. Finally, I'm back to Spy Museum.
For the intervening period, or for people that have just recently came to the podcast, tell us a little bit more about yourself, Janosch. I could do it like in a couple of minutes, but if you could do it, I think it would be even better.
I am a former Russian counterintelligence officer. I was born and grew up in the Soviet Union. I started my service in Russian counterintelligence while I was 17 years old. I graduated from the FSB Academy. My main specialization is investigate crimes and espionage, all forms, political, industrial. Later, I was transferred and worked as an operative, and my job was to recruit sources among Russian and a foreign citizen in economics line. So it was a lot of fun to work with a foreign businessman and recruit them to work for Russian state as a sources. After that, I was appointed as a deputy head of economic security to one of the Russian private banks, which later became the major hub for the state-sponsored money laundering operation. It's a multi-billion dollar operations. You guys most likely heard about this through the magnificent Deutsche Bank operations. So the bank to which I was attached, and where I supervised some operations, actually Deutsche Bank was a partner of this. I don't want to brought any other names because I don't want to go into the court. But So overall, after that, I figured out what this whole thing is about. Initially, my thought was that it was supposed to be some kind of a sting operation. We're doing this favor for our state, and it's like a spy movie. We're doing this work on a global scale. It's interesting. But later, I figured out that's pretty much not about the state. It's all about make money for state officials, including guys inside the Russian intelligence community. And I tried to quit, but there is no way out from the submarine, as I was told. So I had only one choice. They actually gave me three choices. So pretty much go the officer's way. So declassify myself, put it this way. Second, they're going to do it for me or just leave. Leave was the worst option because in this case, you have to take all the shame and blame on yourself. While we've been trying, with my wife as well, we've been trying to figure out how to leave the country. We decided to go the third way. We figured out it's pretty complicated to do because they put flag on us, which is pretty much impossible to leave the country. I used some connections within the counterintelligence service and the guys opened the gates for me. So we've been able to escape, leave Russia in this moment. And we went to Dominican Republic. Choice was because Dominican Republic is, back in the days, had no any kind of really high level of Russian intelligence activity on the ground. No Russian embassy, it was just a consulate. Consulate was under the management of some local person. So this person was not even a Russian citizen. We won some time, we settled on the ground. We figure out communication with the Russian. I had some friends on the ground there, people who been providing me with information about what's going on. And after some time, we figure out that it's pretty impossible to stay on our own and we need some help. And we found a way how to connect with the US officials from the agency. The good news, I was trained to catch them, so it was not a big, really complicated to get in touch with them in this case. So from this moment, we've been transferred by US government on US soil. Even original idea was to let us go to Europe because my wife, she speaks multiple European languages, same as I am. And it would have been pretty easy for us to just melt and just disappear in Europe. I might have opened some flower shop in Lisbon. That was an idea. I mean, honestly, guys, I do love flowers. But again, they brought us to the United States. And here in the States, we've been working for US government agencies for quite a few years, helping in investigate crimes in intelligence, in illegal money laundering, money operations here in the States and overall in Europe and on global scale as well, helped U.S. government and U.S. government allies with some ongoing investigations. So yes, and after some time working for them, we were on our own. And now I'm fully involved in the entertainment industry. We have a really big project coming with the International Spy Museum. I guess we can do some disclosure right now. It calls the Real Spy Comics. That would be the only comic book company which is dedicated to produce stories about the spies, counterintelligence operations, and the special operations only. We're not going to have any superheroes in the spandex. We're going to have superheroes as real people. We're going to tell these stories. We have full support from the intelligence community and the partners in this kind of entity is myself, my partner, Nicholas Leeds, and Spycraft Entertainment, which is run by John Cypher and Jerry Oshie, CIA legends. So that's pretty much what's going on right now.
So much threads that I want to pull on there, but just to go back to the beginning, you come from a family where intelligence is almost a family business, that's correct?
Yeah, that says that I had pretty much no choice where to go. So it's more as it was in Britain and again, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, maybe up to now even. Here in States, up to early 80s, it's old boys club where pretty much system is trying to fulfill itself from within. I guess in this case, they are sure that they're going to have people who are really loyal to the system. And at the same time, people who understand what the system is about. Yes, my parents both were in affiliate organizations back in the Soviet Union. But again, and on the moment when I had to make a decision to leave the country, they were not on my side in this case. So they were, let's say, I can't say they became enemies. No, we just kind of had different opinion about some things.
And the FSB, just for our listeners that don't know, the FSB is the Domestic Security Intelligence Service, right? That's like MI5 and the FBI, or is it something different?
FBI is more as a Russian investigative committee, but FSB has some functions from the FBI, but I would have called FSB as more internal CIA, as you wish, because FSB is doing a lot of work with the unofficial work, let's put it this way, is pretty much like 90% of the whole operations. For FBI to get to some place, you need to have a paperwork from the court. For FSB, not so much. So that's the difference. If FBI is signing contracts with the people if they're working as a sources for the FBI. And FSB is pretty much signing with the devil. You're signing like one-page handwritten agreement that you're going to provide information for an FSB as a source. And there is no expiration date for that. Also, yeah, and of course, FSB is involved on an anti-counter-terrorist kind of operation, working with against some kind of radical elements as well. But pretty much it's a counterintelligence machine which is, covers all spheres of life in Russia. Also, FSB is doing outside work too, which is a mistake when people do think that's a domestic only. No, it's not.
And for the FSB, can you talk about the legacy and the inheritance of the Soviet era? After the Soviet Union dissolves, there's an evolution of the Russian intelligence community, right? And you end up with the SVR, the GRU, and the FSB. So how much of that internal KGB legacy becomes part of the FSB's culture?
Well, starting from the school, from the training, FSB Academy is previously known as a KGB high school. When I was in it, it was already Russia, not the Soviet Union, but right after the collapse of the Soviet Union. All the books were made in the Soviet Union. They had the KGB logos on it. All the teachers came from the KGB system. When I joined the service, all the rules, regulations, pretty much logo on the top of these books were changed. But the same idea was as it was. They just sometimes been telling us just to skip a few pages because these pages were all about the role of political party in our operations. So there's no need in this anymore. The rest was just as it was. Of course, legal system changed slightly. It was just modified. Some articles became less complicated and less, let's say, less useful in our days. But overall, it was pretty much the same organization with the same attitude, same people, same idea. Not much has changed. And I guess right now, I don't know what's going on exactly. I guess they're trying to build their own ideological base. So it will be the maybe like KGB 2.0 with a new ideology integrated into it. For sure, they're not going to use how it was during the Soviet time because no communism in Russia officially. It will be something new, and they're working on it right now. But again, overall, the same thing. Just a best example how it was. In mid and late 90s and early 2000s, I met quite a few high-rank officials. And some of these guys, they had in their offices portrait of the current president, who was a Russian current commander-in-chief. They had the portrait of Dzerzhinsky, then portrait of Andropov, and bunch of icons. I'm not sure how this all can be put together and work, but that's how it was. So I guess that's the strange mix of different philosophies and different angles. But I guess they found their way how to do it.
And Dzerzhinsky is a legendary founding figure in Russian intelligence.
Yes. Iron Felix always was a symbol, and I guess he always will be a symbol of serving to his country.
And Andropov was one of the premiers in the early 80s, I believe.
Yes. Yeah. One, I guess. As for now, after Dzerzhinsky, he is the best head of the Russian Secret Service.
That's right. He was the head of the Secret Service, and then he became the prime minister, the leader of the Soviet Union, and
yes,
afterwards.
Yes, but for a short period of time, he, I guess he died for some liver disease or some kind of medical condition. It was view inside the KGB system and inside the FSB as well that Andropov would have been like a Russian version of the Deng Xiaoping. So his idea was he had like pretty liberal views how the country is supposed to go. And again, overall view is that it would have been less disastrous compared to what Gorbachev was able to accomplish. Mm.
Just out of interest, I'm just walking forward from where you started with your story through to Real Spies, Real Comics. So we spoke about your family and the FSB. I was just wondering, a lot of our listeners, you know, I know that you didn't go through training in the United States, but you're very well connected into that network and you know lots of people. So I just wondered if you had a sense of in any ways in which the training was different. How much of it would you say was similar and how much of it was different?
One thing in common is respect. So basically, it doesn't matter you're trained by Russians, Americans, Brits, Israeli, or someone else. They're going to teach you one thing. You have to respect your opponent, your counterpart. If the worst mistake you can make is underestimation of your abilities of your rivals, so people against whom you're working. So that's the mistake number one. Also, be precise and careful with details because, again, in this business, everything is about details, and that's pretty much the same here in States and in Britain, for example, the guys, you know, Israeli guys training, or Russian training as well. It's hard to say about the intensity of the training because I've never been inside the U.S. training system. As for FSB, it's 5 years. You're training, wow. And then you... It's interesting, it's not only the tradecraft thing itself. You learning a lot of legal stuff too. So it's a law school, it's military training as well. And it's also the tradecraft training too. So you learning not only about how to do things on your side, you learning how your, as Russian call them, partners from the overseas mm-hmm. are doing the job, doing things too. So which is really interesting as well. I guess that was maybe one of the most interesting subjects we have to go through. And again, I'm not sure how it here, but in Russia it was most of the disciplines, they had only a number and it called a special discipline. That's pretty much it. You can't take the textbook back home with you. Not going to happen. You can't take any of your papers which you're writing with you back home as well. So everything's supposed to be, you're supposed to leave it all inside the academy. It's interesting. Yes, you're arriving at 8 o'clock in the morning. You're leaving about 6 p.m. in the evening if you have nothing else to do. So most likely you have to go to the library. You have to stay in the facility. So you have to do some duties as well because, again, it's a partly military training too. So you have to do some senseless duties. So they're trying to make you as busy as possible. I guess maybe that's the right way to do for people who are like age 17 to 20. So keep this energy inside. Otherwise, there's going to be some disaster and some problems. So they've been doing their best trying to make everyone busy as much as possible.
They tend to get recruited younger then because people generally don't join the CIA when they're 17 to 20. It's usually after they've graduated college in the States.
There are some plus and minuses in it. As I said, FSB Academy in this case, they're going to give you like full high-level education. So in my case, it's a master's in law.
Oh, so you're doing a degree as well?
Yeah, that's correct. Right, okay. So yes, you have a master's in law in my case, and you're going for this whole legal training as a normal law school. So imagine on the top of the learning the tradecraft and how your other guy is supposed to do the work, plus the military basic training as well as an officer, you have to go for the law school simultaneously. And during one day, you could have had the subjects from different, kind of from all three different revenues or venues. It's pretty complicated, but it's at the same time, it's really interesting too. But again, maybe that's the reason is because Russians trying to take you as early as possible and then just to build the way they want, the way they see, just to make you just a full integrated part of the system of the machine. In US, they, I guess, seems like they're going to give you their childhood so you can go into the college, have all the fun, and then they're going to put you in service. You're going to spend several years learning and then just join the service. So in our case, we missed all of this fun stuff. Our fun stuff was 28 days a year. The rest was just work.
It sounds very intense.
Yes, but again, you get used to it. And again, the reason is because there is no way out. you pretty much...
Suck it up.
Yeah, you signed that you're going to stay in it. So there's not much of the choice you have.
You mentioned it was the system replenishing itself from within. Was this your father talking to you, or was this someone tapping you on the shoulder, or how did it work?
Because I grew up as a part of this system. So if I remember correctly, I was like age 5. I was sent, it was deep into the Soviet Union time. It was on the pike of the Cold War. I was sent to the summer camp, which belongs to the KGB as well. So imagine that. So all the kids around you, they're pretty much kids from the people from the system, and the teachers or the staff of the summer camp, they are KGB officers in young level, but they all, the guards around the camp, they are KGB guys. So kind of imagine this scale of what's going on. If you're going on vacation with your family, KGB, it was a state inside the state. You had all these resorts under the KGB or military management. So pretty much everyone around you, they're military personnel, so officers, or they're KGB or Russian intelligence personnel as well. So by just growing inside this, by listening to what this guy's been talking about, you're already like a sponge. You're already absorbing all this information and you pretty much where you're going. I had a few attempts just to maybe go like into some normal law school, but it was shut down pretty much instantly. Of course, I had some pep talks with my dad's friends and such, but again, it was just like it was pretty obvious where you're supposed to go. Mm-hmm. Of course, you have to compete. You have to go through this evaluation process. You have to go through the examination and such, but tests. But pretty much the direction where you're going.
And are languages part of that
No, that's the thing. So yeah, in NFSB training it's must have. So a language is a must have thing. How you can recruit a foreign source if you don't speak a language, at least on the basic level? My language is not precise. It's not at Oxford level, but it's enough to recruit a person. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing. So you have to learn.
So you learned English?
I had English, yes, and I had a basic German, and then one thing I'm not going to tell you.
Okay.
But overall, you're learning not only the language, you're learning the culture as well. That's really interesting, because you know with whom you have to work. And how are you going to approach the person if you don't understand the nature of this person, the mentality, the culture, some traditions? Without that, it's pretty much impossible.
I feel like culture is always undervalued. To me, it's like an operating system, and you need to know how to write in within the operating system in a language that it understands. To me, that's almost like what culture is, but people often overlook it and think that it doesn't matter as much as it actually does.
It is matters. Like maybe in a global world, globalistic type of the idea where everything is the same, that's not maybe the key element. But again, back in the 90s and early 2000s, and it seems like in the future, knowing the culture of the person with whom you're working is really important. Because again, by knowing the culture, you mean you're learning the mentality. As long as you know the mentality, you can find the better approach to this person if you want to recruit this person. So it's all piece of the puzzle. You can't just use the same approach to everyone. It's different. It's not going to happen. And also these people are not like living on the same street as you are. They don't grow up in the same street as you are. They came from different places all around the globe. You had to deal with some guys from Belgium and France. You have to find the difference between them and what this guy's up to. And that was always a problem. So kind of you have to be careful what you're saying. And
even northern Belgium and southern Belgium. Right?
Yes, there are a bunch of the complications. And yes, it's interesting.
Just before we move on from the training, I'm sure you will have seen this, but if you watch American movies and TV shows, whenever it shows Soviet or Russian intelligence officers being trained, it's almost like the training that Ivan Drago goes through. They seem to be physical supermen who are running with logs on their back and smashing doors down.
Hold on. Logs on the back, it was Rocky. Drago was going through the really precise training in a really cutting-edge medical facility, which is actually true. If based on the recent doping scandals, pretty much the Drago movie was about the true. So that was
that. I was just drawing on various parts of the movie. But what was it like? How physically onerous was it? And how does that compare to the American system? And as far as you know, what happens in the American system?
Physical culture is a big part of it, big deal. We're not trained as a Navy SEALs, that's for sure. Swimming was a key element, but not the thing you're going to spend all your day doing this. It was a lot of running, what I remember, and I really hate to run. So some basic stuff, like as a normal military guy is going to do, like pull-ups, push-ups, lifting some weights, a lot of martial arts involved as well. But because I was in the investigators, I'm part of the training, so I had to go for the more legal training. And the guys who've been in operative training at the beginning, they've been doing way more than we are, physical training and martial arts. So we spend more time on the books, they spend more time on the tatami. But later I was working as an operative, and I'm going to tell you that spending more time on the books and learning the legal part is more helpful than just throwing people around. So that's what I learned. Again, maybe it's different, someone has different experience, but in my case it was that way. Shooting, different types of weapon systems made in Russia, Soviet Union, made in the West. And FSB Academy, they have a really good collection of stuff, which was, let's say, brought as a presence from all around the globe by Russian intelligence. And cadets can use it and learn it and study it as well. So yeah, it's pretty much on daily basis, you have to do something physical as well. I mean, and look, for 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, 21, 22 years old, that's perfect. You need somehow to release your testosterone, your energy. Otherwise, it's going to end up pretty bad. So I guess they found a way how to deal with it. And then again, while the service was, during the service, every year you have to run some physical tests. And it was interesting then. You're joining the unit. Of course, they're going to send on the young guys to compete and just do this thing. So the older guys are always trying to find an excuse how not to do things. So they're always busy with some operations or somewhere. It was interesting. And again, and before that, I had a sports background. I was in a Central Sports Army Club, again, since I was a kid inside the system. So kind of, yeah, sports always was fun. And again, guys, back in the 80s, 70s, it was not about the computer games because it was not exist. It was all about make yourself busy, and make yourself busy means do sports. It was pretty lame not to be involved in any sports. So pretty much you can't get a girlfriend if you're not doing anything. So that's
the context. And this training was in Moscow?
Yeah. Clear Moscow area. Logistically, it's kind of, it had more sense. And they have a bunch of the facilities. So yeah, it was not a big deal.
Just out of interest, people back home where I'm from say Moscow, but people in the States say Moscow. What's the one that's closer to how Russians pronounce it?
None of that.
None of it. Okay. How would the Russians pronounce it?
Moskva.
Okay. Wow. And then from there, so the investigation and then you become an operative. Help me understand this. Are you undercover when you're doing this, or is it more like the FBI where people know what your job is and you're walking around with the suit and the gun and stuff? Help us understand what the environment is like.
Well, I mean, you have to wear the suit, yes, because I was working in the headquarters. But again, if you're going on some operation, suit is not necessary. Jeans, some jacket and such. Of course, we had all had cover IDs too. So besides your official credential with your name in it, and which is matching your passport and such, we had cover passports, cover credentials. We had even police credentials. Just to be sure we have it all. It all depends how you're going to do and what you're doing, what kind of operation is going, whom you're going to approach. Some people you're not going to approach as an FSB, it will be a different flag. Maybe they do understand with whom they're talking, but it's not necessary for you just to flash your credential around. Back in the days, it was no such thing as a badge. So no fancy stuff like an FBI. But everyone's trying to stay as modest as possible and just not to show your credentials. You have ability to carry the gun, but not many guys have been doing this. The reason is it's a gun is going to bring your intention to you. Plus, I do believe that bringing gun into some meetings with the people who want to recruit, especially business people, not going to give you anything. It's going to be against you just because it means bringing the gun, it's a sign of mistrust. People won't be happy to talk to you. They're going to feel insecure. And I was carrying this just several times when I had to, but no. Yeah, as I said, FSB is more, you're pretty much doing the spy work. Again, it's in a unit where I was working.
And I meant to follow up on this point, when you watch the training for Russian intelligence officers and movies or TV shows, you had a look there, oh my God, don't even go there. So I just wondered if you could share with our listeners, what are the kind of things that when you watch this, you'd say to your, what do you rant to your wife about? What are you like, what the heck are they doing? This is so wrong.
Not much was shown in American movies about the kind of male training with the Russian spies. It was more about like guys with a really strong Russian accent who doing this, I mean, which is ridiculous. But so my wife, she went through the same training as I am, and she was working in the same system as I am. But she's way more educated and more trained than I am at some point, and she's more a cyber person. When we tried to watch the Red Sparrow, it's pretty much ended for us in the first 20 minutes. We were not able to stand it. So again, if you look at this movie, just keep in mind, not even close to reality. So it's always exaggerated. It's always guys trying to make Russians to look as if they are super crazy, and they're always pushing them over the limits. It's like a Navy SEALs training on the steroids. No, that's not true as well. So it's no one is trying to kill you during the training. They're just trying to push you to show your best. But again, what they're telling you, and that's most important, you're doing this not for us, you're doing this for yourself. More you can observe, more you can learn, more you can get from what you're doing, it's going to help you more in the future. If you want to pass on it, fine, pass on it. But then you're going to struggle when you're going to join the service. So it's faster you're going to understand why do we need it, better for you. But then the interesting part is, when I came to work initially as an investigator, I had my own like a big office space and just my personal room with all this fancy stuff in it. First thing what they told me, just forget about everything what you learned in the academy. So
5 years.
5 years wasted, yes. So then I joined the operative unit. The guy's been really suspicious because you came as an investigator. So you're basically just decreasing yourself from to the operative level. My boss back in the day, he was like old KGB type shark operative who spent his career inside the service. he told me, like, okay, first of all, forget about everything what you learned in the academy. Now forget about everything what you've been doing as an investigator. Just you have to learn from the beginning. It's like...
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
For our listeners, like, just to come back to your career, so what types of places were you? Were you in Moscow, St. Petersburg, other parts of the country, other parts of the world, other parts of Europe, or all of the above?
Was my main place of work was, of course, Moscow, but due to I had the sources, I had to travel as well just to meet with the guys. I had quite a few trips outside the Russia, so primarily Europe, and of course inside the Russia too. But again, it was kind of just a routine, it's not normal work. It was not like I was stationed somewhere, I was just sent somewhere. No, short trips, few days, maybe a week or so. Nice, one trip was really nice. I had to meet with the guys from like a Polish potential future sources. And I even had to travel to Egypt on a diving resort. It was really nice. So state paid for it, and it was nice. I spent really nice time and pretty successful dealing with these guys.
Sharm El Sheikh. Okay. So beside the ethics and the morality of the system, did you enjoy the work? Did you enjoy the investigating, the analyzing, identifying, recruiting sources, all of that more day-to-day type stuff?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a game at some point. You're just playing this game. I mean, being honest with you, it's not a James Bond movie. So 60% of the time, you have to do a lot of really boring paperwork, which is downside of all the work for the state. And it's annoying, but the rest is really entertaining. You're meeting really cool people, interesting characters, or interesting backgrounds, interesting stories. You're just playing this mind games. You're playing like a big chess game. You pretty much on your own. At some point, you just some rules, regulations, not so much. It doesn't mean that you have to run like Jason Bourne and shoot everyone around. No, not going to happen. No, it's not. It means that you have to be creative. You have to think outside the box. You can't have a tunnel vision. This is no go. It's more, the work as operatives I do, it's more like a form of art, put it this way. I do consider tradecraft as a form of art. It's not the craft itself. You can't just do because if it's a craft, then it means you have to do the same thing again, again, and again. It's not a mass-scale production. It's art because every source is unique. Every person is unique. Every operation is unique. Yes, something, some small things may be matching, but overall, it's every time it's a new challenge. It's a new goal. And you have to prepare yourself. Yeah. I'm not a big fan of ballet, but one of my sources was a big ballet fan. So I had to go to the Bolshoi Theater, watch this again and again and again. I had to do some learning, just at least to be able just to talk to the guy. But same thing was happening with the art as well. I do have some small background in art school. So going to some galleries and talk to the people, just establish this contact, be sure that you're using at least same terminology as they are, just to get into this and just to be able then in the future to support the conversation, be interesting to this person whom you're trying to approach. So it's all really, really interesting part of work. And again, you have to self you have to do your homework. You have to develop yourself. You have to improve yourself all the time on a small thing. You have like a self-growth process, as you wish. It's not just because I have so much free time, I have to do it. No, because that's the part of the work. Otherwise, you won't be able to succeed in what you do. If you're not learning, then what's the point of you? Yeah, that's interesting. But again, it's entertaining, it's interesting. And yeah, I really enjoyed some work, some stuff I was doing. But I was not a big fan of paperwork.
I find this really interesting. For you, do you think this was something that you were born with? Are good recruiters born with this intuitive understanding of other human beings? Or is this something that you're taught, or is it a combination of both? Because it's quite interesting, because it's a very refined game that has to be played. It's almost like being an actor, but with additional responsibilities and the stakes being much higher. You have to constantly think about how you can mold and shape yourself so that you're going to fit into a particular situation. So for creating that person that can communicate with someone that's into ballet, that's a very refined kind of nuanced thing to be able to do. So is that something that most people like you were born with, do you find, or do you find that it's more something that you learned and developed, or was it a little bit of both?
It's pretty much like in any business. It's about 10% of talent. The rest is just hard work. So we're all born with some things. It's just the question is how we develop them. So in this case, you have to be friendly. You have to be not just completely open, but just friendly, be able to make friends, establish contact with the people. Not to be open just to leak some information, not to look silly in this case, but more as kind of be interesting to these people. As you said, it's like acting. You're just in this character. You're playing this. And again, keep in mind, you have different sources, different people, different mentalities. They have different religion beliefs, different kind of social status, whatever it is. And for each person, you have to adopt yourself. So it's exactly as an acting as well. So you have to, like chameleon, as you wish. For every person, you have to kind of adjust yourself just to be sure that you're matching and you're still interesting to this person. And you can just keep going and do some work with this person. And one day you might have several meetings with different people. So keep in mind that you have to reset. So with someone, you maybe have to go, people have different background. One of my guys who was working for me, he had a criminal background, even he was a high-ranked businessman. But again, in this case, you have to be on his wave, and just maybe throw some criminal terminology as well, do some kind of a hand talking, like the Soprano family type thing. And then for the other guys, you have to be more as an intelligentsia type thing. You have to wear your glasses, and you have to talk about some high-level art, contemporary art stuff, at least just to get into the conversation. So you have to switch, you have to adjust yourself. As a talent, who knows? I don't know. I think you can develop it. But again, naturally, you should be able to communicate with people. That's the thing, I guess, you only can be born with. Or maybe it's maybe kind of a family thing. A family can teach you how to do it. So open to people, open to the conversation, be able to sustain the conversation, just be in it, be part of it, yes. All the rest you can learn. How to approach, what kind of tactic and technique you can use, is again. And then you can find your own way how to use it. You can't do anything by book, by page. This is the dead end. No, because it's not ABC. It's always like D can be on the top of A. You just kind of have to find your way how to deal with it. It's pretty much like a creative mess, as you wish. And you just need to find yourself how to deal with it.
So you could be meeting a few different sources in the same day, and I understand that there has to be a mental shift and reset, but you mentioned the glasses there. So would you also, for one person, I'm going to be wearing a suit and looking very businesslike. For another person, I'm going to look very bohemian. For someone else, I'm just going to look like Joe Average.
Yeah.
Would that be part of it as well? Your hair, your persona, the way that you would carry yourself?
Yeah, you have to, again, as I said, you have to adopt yourself to each meeting, to each person, to each personality. It all depends. You can't, if you're going to treat them all the same, they're not going to have any interest to talk to you. So they want to see in you not only their handler, whom they are supporting the information. They want to see in you just like a friend, let's say a business partner, someone with whom they are willing to share some information, and actually whom you have to ask for favors to do some work. And it's more like it's acting. It's you're preparing yourself for this scene, and you're adopting yourself to this particular conversation. So when you go into the meeting, you're already playing this in your head. What you're going to do, and it all depends upon what kind of task was given to this person, what information you received, what you're looking for, blah blah blah. So it's a lot of different aspects. But again, you have to adjust yourself. You have to be flexible, let's say, in your mind, which is really the most important part, and be able to control your emotions. Because people coming to you, they have maybe had bad days, some problems in the family, they're afraid to do the thing you ask them to do, they feel really uncomfortable to do this stuff. So you have to understand that you have a lot of responsibility, you're handling them. You're not only just giving them a task, you have to tell them how to do it. You're training them as well. As an operative, you have to train your source how to do the things. You're not only just, okay, you have to do this and that, you just go ahead, do it. No. You have to teach them how maybe this could be done. Some kind of do some small brainstorm, explain to them how things could go and what if this is not going to happen. So what's the step? What's the plan B? What's the plan C? It's interesting work. But again, I don't know if I say anything inappropriate. But in this case, if you're not completely normal person, this may be better for you if you're working as an operative. So in this case, you can have like several personalities in your head and you just can adjust yourself.
Okay.
But again, it's not like you're supposed to be nuts and crazy. No, it's just, it means that you have to be in the state of mind, like flexible mind, be open for something new, be open to adjust yourself for kind of new challenge, for something new all the time, and be able to hold your emotions. Because I mean, look, you do know that something you're going to tell this person to do might be dangerous for this person at some point, right? So you have to take this responsibility, because here is a priority. Priority is just to get this information from this person and help your state. But you do know that this might be dangerous at some point.
I'm sure many listeners have had this, but when there's someone that you like and you want to ask them out on a date, or it's like a wooing or a seduction, there's a certain, or if you want to think about it like a salesman, there's like a closing pitch. And that can be, I'm sure everybody's had the experience where it goes really well, and then there's other experiences where it really doesn't. Through experience, you get better at it. How do you make sure you're not having you do this delicate dance to get them to a point, and then you go in with a clumsy close and the recoil, like, what are you doing? Like that, I guess that final closing the deal, tell us about that part of it.
It's hard to explain. I mean, if you wish, this job is more as you're like a shoe salesman in selling the shoes for the woman. And every time you have to be nice, polite, you have to find your way how to do it, how to close the deal. And just, again, people coming with different background and some different mood, something maybe happened. And you always have to find your way how to adjust yourself and deal with it. It's unique. There is no, like, again, no ABCD. You can't just follow just normal standard procedures. That's not the way it's done. It's always something different. It's, again, it's hard to explain. You need to put yourself in a specific situation with a specific condition, knowing what's going on with this person. Some people, especially if it's a female source, she's going to come to you and she's going to, for next maybe 30 minutes, going to explain how was her day, how bad her husband or boyfriend, and you have to listen all, you have to absorb it. By the way, to this job, you have to be a good listener. That's really important, because you have to maybe at some point talk less, just ask some sharp questions, let person just lick it, just let it go.
Just let them talk.
Let them talk. You just need to guide them where to go with it. Some people are crazy with that, especially people from the scientific background. Engineers, scientists, some of them, it's impossible to shut them. After all, so kind of, you already know you have to run and you're just trying to find a way how to get out of it. Because from 45 minutes monologue from this person, you maybe need only one sentence. But overall, you have to listen, you have to get it.
And here at the Spy Museum, we talk about some of the motivations for becoming a spy or becoming a source or an agent: money, ideology, coercion, ego. There's other ones you can add: love, seduction, a whole variety of things. Like, for each source, I know you said it's very specific, a very specific set of conditions, a very specific person. You have to tailor your approach. But help our listeners understand, like, out of all of those different ways that you can try to get leverage, how do you decide which one it is? Is it just a case of when you're in the deep context of the moment and you're reading the situation, you just have an understanding of, yeah, this is going to be the best way to try to recruit this person?
To be a spy, that's a different type of story, right? So it's all about your choices. Do you want to do it? How you don't understand what this is about? If you've been watching a lot of James Bond, Jason Bourne movies, it's not the way to go. So forget about this. No one's going to spend that much money on you. No one's going to give you that much money to live on. You're not going to drive the Rolls Royce or Bentley. At some point, yes, but no. For 99%, salary is not that fantastic. Doesn't matter for whom you're working, where you're working. It's like, so forget about this. So you kind of, it's supposed to be like really a weighed in decision. I want to do it. I want to serve my country. It's going to be about the country. It's not about you. If we're talking about the source or agents, as we call them in Russian terminology, agents, it's a person whom you recruited. It's not how here in States, a federal agent. No, it's source. As for the source, it's not, okay, well, this guy looks good, or this girl looks good on the street, let me recruit her. No, you have to do a lot of preparation, a lot of work. Sometimes this could take years just to get to this person. You have to collect all the possible information as much as you can. So you're building like the whole profile, the whole portfolio, as you wish, the case about this person would be the candidate for the recruitment for a long period of time. You have to establish the connection with this person somehow. I started to build a relationship. For a long time, this person might have no idea who you are, for whom you're working. You're just a friend among the other friends. You're just kind of hanging together and just maybe going to the same gallery or to the same theater all the time. You just have a chit-chat, small talk. But at the same time, you're still collecting the information. Maybe you can push one of your existing sources close to this person to collect more information, to task your source just to ask some kind of questions to this person. To check what this person is up to, what's her, let's say, political views, what's her financial situation, what's going on in her mind and such, or his mind. So you have to build it all, like you're building this case, and then you can make a decision how you want to approach and what you're going to do with it. Again, you have several options. Maybe you can just convince this person, and based on this profile, this case, you can say, okay, this person might be going to work for the RFO organization based on a moral patriotic base. So the person really believes that what the organization is doing is really great. And this is this person's way to serve the country. And this is the right approach. And again, most of the people going this way. But they're going to have some benefits from this cooperation as well. So financial benefits, help for the family, maybe to put someone into a good job or help kids to get into university and such. So the organization will help too. Even if the person was recruited based on moral patriotic way. If person is really well set and a rich, let's say, person is a businessman or some entrepreneur, weird French word, by the way, you still can find the way how to work with them. Maybe they're not interested in money in this case, but they need some, let's say, favors for their business going. So that's the way to approach as well. And they do know if they cooperate, they will have some green light on some things. State can close their eyes on some taxation, let's say, issues or some kind of trading operations, or maybe help them to get a good contract with a state-affiliated big company involved in some energy business or construction. So that's all could be part of the how to do it. Some people maybe will have information, organizations have information about this person is pretty dirty, involved in some illegal activity, and in this case, blackmail. That's the way to approach. So again, FSB goal is not to put anyone in jail. FSB goal is to control the information and keep flow of the information going. So in this case, you just can use this person as a recruit this person, approach this person based on the compromat. The great word for the spy museum, compromat materials, which you have. So that's the way to go as well. So a person will be working for you just because you allow this person to keep going with his or her business and you're not going to put them in jail, not going to open any case. But you have something which you can use and motivate this person to do the work.
Yeah, so part of the answer comes in the process of establishing the relationship and doing the research to understand more about them and who they are and just building that picture out. So the way to approach them just partly comes in that research process and in the process of building the relationship.
Yeah, you learning again, doing again, 60% of the boring part of the work, collecting the information. Could be different type of sources. You can collect this information about this person whom you want to recruit from already existing sources. So you can push your sources next to this person. And we'll call it light up. So get some light on the spot, check what this person is about. This is one way. Second way, you're going to put all the government, state, hell on wheels machine and you can get all the data about this person. Again, medical records, taxations, property, family connections, just name it. You're going to find a way, you can find a way how to get personal files of this about this person from the place where the person is working. Even the business, we all have our history. It's a world where everything is recorded. This could be done as well. Cyber stuff. What this person is searching on the internet, what kind of websites visiting, what kind of member of which clubs or some organizations or groups, all comes to you. Checking what kind of activity this person is up to. Maybe person is involved in some charities. Maybe not so much. Maybe person is going to some kind of a shooting range in club. Maybe this person going into the theater all the time, same thing, just hanging with. It's all going to be collected in one bulk of information which you can evaluate and work on. And based on that, you can find the right approach to this person. In friends of this person, it's really interesting as well, because your friends is going to put some influence on you. You're always going to have some kind of effect of the communication with these guys, right? So that's important too. So maybe you can find first, get access to these friends, and then from them to this person. Operative work is like a shark. You have to circle around the potential prey again, again, and again. And there is a other part of the joke that why sharks are circling around the prey, because in this case, there's going to be a less negative part inside this person, because person is afraid, releasing this stuff all around the place. So you have to, if you're circling, cleaner the view, cleaner the picture you have.
Mm. Have you ever circled around a source and found another shark and also doing the same thing?
Yes, and it's because, again, you have to check for your own internal system too.
To see if it's a friendly shark or...
if it was already recruited by someone. And quite a few times I had a call on my special operation phone saying, dude, this is ours.
Back off.
Yeah, back off. It was already recruited. So yeah, just don't go this way. But again, yeah, this could happen. And sometimes you can see that someone else is around. And I had the situations too as well. It was really a kind of ugly situation when the guy was pretending that he's an engineer. And obviously, it was obvious for me that the guy is just from one of the competing organizations, but he had nothing to do with engineering. That's for sure.
So that was someone from a competing organization domestically, or was this someone from
Domestically. Domestically, okay. Yes. It's one of the guys from the different department. And I saw him in the corridors. Yeah, dude, you're not an engineer. You just skip it. We spent the night, evening, good evening, and then I just met him in one of the corridors. I just stepped back.
But you've never
this is mine.
But you've never had the experience where a shark from a foreign country or...
No, they're not the sharks. They're prey in this case. We do know that it's always a part of the game too. When you're checking your source, there's always a possibility that this source was already working for some foreign intelligence agency. And here's the reason. If we're interested in this source as an organization, it means that this person has some value. Value means capabilities or information, access to the information. If we know of that, other guys could know this about this too. So it means that there is always a possibility that this person was approached or might be approached or somehow been involved in some activity from the other side too. So that's always part of the game as well. It's just kind of, it's just, you're just coexisting with that. You just have to adjust yourself. And again, that's a big deal too. Let's say a person is working for some state-affiliated agency or for some science research institute, let's say, right? In this case, yes, this person's potentially high-profile target and potential target for foreign intelligence services, 100%. So when you're approaching this person or doing some research, you already have to you have to keep it in your head that this, yes, person maybe was recruited or maybe will be recruited or he's or she is a potential target for an intelligence service. And of course, if your person is clean, you recruited this person, you have to explain to this person that based on his or her profile, what type of work they're doing, what type of information they have access to, they could be approached by other guys as well. And then you have to explain what kind of indications if someone is approaching you. You're pretty much explaining this person how you approach this person. So why? What the pattern kind of gave you this picture that this person for whom you need is a potential target. So, and yeah. And then, yeah, one... Kind of, I had a few. One only was confirmed. Other one, the person was just really paranoid. But in one case, yes, it was indication and some kind of signs that this person was approached by foreign intelligence service. But again, his response was into this to this approach was not what he was asked by us to do. So we tried to explain to him, be gentle. If the approach is good, it's not bad, because in this case, we can put it into a game, we can play with it. But the person decided, yeah, use his fist on the table and just, no, I'm not going to work for you guys. Screw you, I'm going to report you. It's like, come on, man.
At the beginning, you mentioned counterintelligence, that you're an FSB counterintelligence officer. So just for our listeners that aren't part of this world, that means that you're recruiting sources to get information about foreign powers that are trying to spy on Russia?
Yeah. Yes, foreign sources who will be not spying on Russia, but spying for Russia, collecting information on behalf of the Russian state. That's what we're looking for. When we're recruiting source, we need the source to give us information about what's going on outside. If it's a foreign businessman, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what we're looking for.
Okay.
Yes, sorry.
But would you also be looking for your friend John Cypher now? He was the chief of station in Moscow. Would that also be part of, not necessarily what you'd done when you were in, but that's what FSB would do as well? They would try to figure out who was the intelligence officers and the American embassies and consulates and so forth?
Of course, that's the huge part of the game. Basically, find, identify, and be sure that this guy is not able to function on Russian soil. It's not only Americans, it's the Brits, again, Israeli, French, Germans, Belgians, everyone. So Moscow, it's a huge, Russia itself, and it's a huge kind of point of interest for foreign intelligence agencies, like the United States, for example, as well, same here. And everyone, like, just name the country, you know the spies are here. So your main job is just to identify, find them, and be sure that they won't be able to operate. Mm-hmm. So it's not Hollywood, no one's going to try to kill anyone. The idea is just to be sure that guys were not able to run an intelligence operation on Russian soil. Yes. And of course, when you're working with your sources, like in my case, you have to orient your sources to identify these potential threats. So you're teaching your sources, report to you, and keep attention, keep an eye on kind of activity like that. You can explain to them what they have to look for, what they have to listen for, where maybe at some point you just can target them, just specifically just go and check this person. Try to approach, circle around. We'll see if the person is going to approach you. That's a bingo. It's like different layers of the game all the time. So it's multitasking, put it this way. It's not just one line of work. Like, we just need how this money goes. No, it's a pretty broad approach.
For this as well, we had a CIA operations officer on a couple of months back, and he said that 10% of CIA operations officers recruit 90% of the good sources, and the other 90% recruit the other 10%. Did you find the same thing in the FSB?
Yeah, it's pretty much the same thing. It's just, look, to get, put it this way, let's just give you an example. Let's use example not of the country, but let's say a corporation. Inside the corporation, you have about 25,000, 50,000, whatever it is, workers. How many of them have access to really sensitive information about this company? 1%, maybe. So it's pretty much top level management, some engineers and such, right? So you have about 5 or 10 operatives that are working in this company. Easiest target to recruit workers. How much information they can give you? They can give you something, but it's not so much, right? So it's easy target. Maybe some of them will be recruited. You can learn a thing or two. Let's say you have several operatives are gone. They're just busy with that. Then you have people who will work in the higher level, like mid-level management. They might recruit 1 or 2 people. Fantastic. And then maybe one will be able to recruit someone at high executive level who has access to everything. That's pretty much the pure mathematics in this. Same thing is here. Like, you, out of 1,000 people out there, maybe one has access to something really valuable. The rest can give you just overall information, small tiny piece of the puzzle. Maybe they heard some rumors. Maybe they had some kind of a small piece of paper on their table, which is really interesting for us. But it's not going to give you the full picture. So maybe only one person out of this 1,000 is going to have the access to the full picture. So if you recruit them, yes, that's a bingo. That's your golden fish. That's the main asset you have. All the rest of the guys, they're still doing the work as well. They're still giving you some piece of the information. But again, it's not the holy grail of all of it.
It would be great to go over more of the story. Maybe we can do this another time about your defection from Russia and coming to the States. And, you know, we've spoke about this. You've had a very long and torturous and complicated process. So maybe we can do that another time. I just want to go on to discuss what you're up to now, because it's very interesting. So tell us what you're up to now. So you mentioned Real Spy, Real Stories. You're involved with Spycraft. So there's lots of things that you have going on. So just tell us a little bit more about what you're up to now.
Will do. So several years ago, I started to work with a publishing company, comic publishing company called the Aftershock Comics. Guys are really great. And I made already two books with them. One was Red Atlantis. It's I'm co-creator of the original idea together with my wife, Victoria, and my writing partner, Nicholas Leeds from LA. Project was submitted to Aftershock by our another friend, Ross Schneiderman, who is a former editor of the Newsweek, whom we actually just asked, Ross, in your opinion, can you read the story? And we thought we were writing some TV series. So Ross took it, and without telling us, he just sent it to Aftershock, to his friend, Lee Kramer, who is owner of the company. And about a week later, we've got an offer to make a comic book based on that. So we said, yeah, why not? Let's try. So that was my first comic book experience. They gave us absolutely phenomenal showrunner, Stephanie Phillips. We've been working with her all the way. Whole book was accomplished. It was released 2 years ago. And it was actually on sale in the International Spy Museum. I guess, I'm not sure, guys, you still can, but maybe you can buy it in Spy Museum. Otherwise, you can buy it in Barnes & Noble, and you can check your local comic stores. I'm not sure they have it or not, but 5-in-1 edition was released, 120 pages book was released last year. And again, still you can buy it in Barnes & Noble. I guess it's available on Amazon, maybe some other places. Just check, just Google it. For sure, you can find it through the international, through Aftershock website. So that was one story. It was sci-fi, paranormal, spy thriller. Interesting element, I guess, in issue one. Fighting scene when the main character fighting with the two federal agents here in the States, it was actually orchestrated. We filmed it. My wife and I, we've been fighting. We just filmed it and we sent it to the writer and the artist and they put it all together. She's a martial artist as well. So for her, it was easy to get it. But again, scene is completely authentic. So after that, Aftershock, we had this idea to do the graphic novel based on our journey here in States, in United States, from the moment we arrived to Dominican Republic and up to now. Aftershock said, let's do the graphic novel based on that. And they call it Almost American. We worked together with Ron Martz, who is absolutely a phenomenal writer. And the book was released last September, so September 2021. Now all five issues are out there. You can find them in comic book stores. You can find them online as well. And 5-in-1, so 120-something pages with extra material is coming in a few weeks. Unfortunately, to the global supply chain crisis, it was delayed on 3 months due to it was, surprise, surprise, no paper in Canada. So finally, it was printed, and now it will be in the stores. And again, Barnes & Noble, Spy Museum, Amazon, comic book shops. Guys, check it there. Stories told in my voice, because my wife, she wants to tell the story of how she sees it. I think it will be a lot of negative about me in this case, but I want to give her this chance, let her deal with that. Working on these two graphic novels gave me an idea, like, why we can't make something on our own. And I wanted this to be owned from the intelligence community. So I discussed it with John Cypher and Jerry Oshie. We put some ideas together. Now we are in the middle of talks with the potential partners and investors for this project. Hopefully soon we can secure the deal and we can launch this enterprise. And we will be one of the kind, the only existing graphic novel company, which is really dedicated to tell the stories about the spies, special ops and confidential officers all around the globe. Range of the stories pretty much before the crisis and up to now. So a huge playground and we want to tell just these stories. Besides that, I'm working on several projects. I'm consulting a few books, and we're going to discuss pretty soon one of the book with one of the former CIA analysts. It's a really great book is coming, and I was consulting them on the Russian side. I'm not going to tell anything more. I am involved in several TV projects right now. We're developing them with documentary projects, working with a really great team. It's a documentary series about crazy Soviet paranormal experience. Like in US, it was MKUltra. In the Soviet Union, it was like a nuclear punk type thing. So they've been trying to train ghosts as a spies. They've been trying to create some superhuman hybrid apes just to work in some some minings in the middle of Siberia. So we kind of want to tell the stories. It's more like a Mythbusters from the spy perspective. I'll show Andrew a link. He won't be able to distribute it, but it's a cool one. We have several other documentary series. Besides that, it's pretty much that's it. The rest of the project is really, really on raw stage, so I can't give you any details, but it's going to happen.
Okay. And Real Spies, Real Stories, just to summarize, it's basically a series where the stories of intelligence officers, intelligence operations are going to be told. They're going to be based on real events.
That's correct.
To be based on the stories of real historical examples that happened in history. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spycast. Go to our webpage where you can find links to further resources, detailed show notes, and full transcripts. We have over 500 episodes in our back catalogue for you to explore. Please follow the show on Twitter at @intlspycast and share your favourite quotes and insights or start a conversation. If you have any additional feedback, please email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Hammond, and you can connect with me on LinkedIn or follow me on Twitter at @spyhistorian. This show is brought to you from the home of the world's preeminent collection of intelligence and espionage-related artifacts, the International Spy Museum. The Spycast team includes Mike Mincy and Memphis Vaughn III. See you for next week's show.